It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn how one group is enlisting the help of citizen scientists in its effort to track the health of wildlife.
But first, we turn our attention to Nairobi, Kenya, where gunmen opened fire on an upscale shopping mall.
At least 60 people are reported dead, and there's been an ongoing hostage situation involving an estimated 10 to 15 militant attackers.
The group reportedly behind the terror plot is Al-Shabaab, an extremist Islamic group based in Somalia.
But who are Al-Shabaab, and what's led to this weekend's attack? Well, here to explain is Jeremy Suri. He's Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on, Veronica.
Well, Al-Shabaab is a group that we haven't heard that much about, at least in the U.S. media. What do we need to know about it?
Well, there's a lot that can be said, but there are three things I think we would want to make sure we keep in mind. First of all, they're a group that grew out of the dissolution of a longstanding military dictatorship in Somalia in the 1990s and the civil war that followed. Second, they are closely associated with a number of Islamic extremists, though that does not mean that everyone in the group is an Islamic extremist, whatever that means. And then third, they've been engaged in an effort to gain control of Somalia, a battle they have been losing the prior few years. And it looks as if they've turned to these international terrorist activities because they're not winning on the battlefield, in fact.
Well, tell us a little bit about what we know about why this Somalia-based group targeted a site in Nairobi, Kenya.
Well, the Kenyan military, along with African Union forces, has been involved in trying to bring peace and stability to Somalia, trying to support the national government, which is the enemy of the Al-Shabaab group and its supporters. And the Kenyan military has been playing the role both of enforcer and, to some extent, peacekeeper. So this was a successful story for Kenya and the African Union, but it's not seen that way by members of Al-Shabaab, and they're, in a sense, taking out revenge on the Kenyan military.
Now, do we know how much this group is trying to become a global terrorist threat and how much they're simply interested in regaining a foothold in Somalia?
Well, that's the big debate that all the experts in my field are having as we speak. And I, quite frankly, myself don't know for certain. I don't have any inside knowledge on that. It appears that the group Al-Shabaab is recruiting people from outside of Somalia. There's even talk of there being some external, some even Western members of the group that attacked the mall in Nairobi. And it appears that they are looking to use international terror as a weapon. But whether they're seeking to do that on a global scale, I'm not sure. They look to me like a regional terrorist organization now, operating throughout Northern Africa and maybe even in the Middle East. It's hard for me to see evidence of them acting beyond those regional areas right now.
Now, besides this mall in Nairobi, Kenya, are there other ongoing threats or previous attacks that have been put down to Al-Shabaab?
Well, they are they're the ones who people believe, experts believe, are responsible for a number of attacks in Uganda in 2010. And there are a number of other allegations that they've been involved in other smaller-scale attacks. What we do know for certain is that they were on a watch list by American, Kenyan, Israeli, and other intelligence agencies. And, in fact, this mall in Kenya was a target that many had worried about, and there had been efforts to get the Kenyan government to secure them all better. So this did not come out of the blue. It might be unheard of to American newspaper readers, but intelligence agencies have been focused on this group for quite a while.
Now, you mentioned earlier that they had some affiliations with other terrorist organizations. Is Al-Qaeda one of them, and how deep do those ties go?
Well, that's also a very complicated question. There are members of what had been Al-Qaeda or still is Al-Qaeda who have some connections to Al-Shabaab. But what I think it's really important that listeners understand is that Al-Qaeda is no longer a very centralized organization. It's not based around one figure like Osama bin Laden. There are many offshoots, many groups that claim to be part of Al-Qaeda that are not. It's a very loose organization. And there are people from that loose organization that have been associated with Al-Shabaab. But I don't think this is some plot that's been cooked up by some figure in Afghanistan, as we had with September 11th. This is a much more loosely organized network.
Now, I suppose if we're looking at ties between Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda, one thing that people in the United States might wonder is, does that mean that the U.S. and its interests abroad are now a target of this group as well, especially if it's trying to have a more international profile?
Well, I think we already were a target, and they were not necessarily directly involved with the attack on the American embassy in 1998, but the American embassy in Nairobi was attacked for similar reasons because of our presence in the region. We are seen as a supporter in the region of governments that are not favorable to Islamist groups, and so we are a target, and I think we can expect that we'll be even more of a target in that region. I'm not sure this should lead us to worry more about other parts of the world, but perhaps it raises a premium on people attacking American installations. That's a possibility.
So do you know of any ongoing U.S. efforts to combat al-Shabaab, similar to what we may have done in an offensive against al-Qaeda?
Yes. I mean, we've been involved already in helping the Kenyan military and helping the African Union both take away their supply lines, limit their access to capital, financial capital, intercept their communications. We've been sharing intelligence with the Kenyan military. We actually have a very close working relationship, our military intelligence does, with the Kenyan military intelligence units. So we've already been working against this group. And as I said, there had already been plans to try to secure areas in Nairobi that were seen as possible targets. And this is one of the reasons why I think it is fair to assume that al-Shabaab will attack American installations or try to because of our close relationship with the Kenyan military.
So what do you think the Obama administration is thinking now that this is a big, high-profile terrorist attack with U.S. ties? They are there. They might not be as apparent, you know, when you're sitting here in America, but
right.
How does it look to the Obama administration?
Well, I think, first of all, it raises concerns that there will be attacks on Americans in the region. And as bad as this is, it's, of course, much more of a concern to the President of the United States when Americans are directly targeted. And I think there is also concern that we'll see copycat, even if not directly related, activities elsewhere. This will, in the short run, however, reaffirm our connection to Kenya, the Kenyan government, and it will reaffirm our efforts to support those governments in the region that are fighting against al-Shabaab. So it will actually reinforce American policy and make it more public than it has been before.
Now, in the earlier days when we were fighting al-Qaeda, analysts compared it to a many-headed hydra. You cut off one head, another pops up. Is this just another head, or is al-Qaeda and terrorist organization in general weakening globally, do you think? And this is maybe an outlier.
Well, I think this is a very hard question to operate and really put into practice when you're doing research. My sense from reading some of the material about these groups is that they are less capable today, Veronica, than they were 10 years ago to launch a big attack on a hardened target in the United States or somewhere else. So I don't think a September 11th attack is as likely or they're as capable of it as they were before. On the other hand, I think there are more of these small groups. I wouldn't call it a many-headed hydra. I call them franchises. Small outgrowths, small separate businesses that are loosely associated with a central terrorist ambition. And they are operating on a smaller scale, and they can actually operate more easily. Think of all the soft targets, malls and things of that sort around the world. And they are capable of getting weapons and training themselves and recruiting people to take on these attacks. So they are more capable, the terrorists are, of small attacks. I think they're less capable of big attacks.
Now, do you expect any response from the U.S. or maybe a U.N. response to this?
I think there will be more aid, military aid in particular, to Kenyan and African Union forces that are fighting in the southern Somali countryside al-Shabaab groups. You will see more efforts to find where their money is and intercept that, more efforts to intercept their communications. And if we are able to find some of the leaders of the group, people we think are leaders, and we can kill them with drones, I don't think it's unthinkable that Obama would use drones in this region where he has not used them as far as we know yet. But I don't know if we have the ability to target and figure out who the leaders of this group are.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jeremy Soria, professor at the University of Texas, Austin.
For more on this topic, tune into the Kathleen Dunn Show tomorrow. Kathleen will talk to an expert on East African politics after 1.
Coming up, maybe you can help scientists keep tabs on the health of Wisconsin's wildlife. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. A new project is looking for your help in keeping tabs on Wisconsin wildlife. The Wildlife Data Integration Network is out to create more citizen scientists to help them get a more complete picture of wildlife health. We have Megan Hines and Chris Marsh in the studio with us. They're both with the Wildlife Data Integration Network. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Chris, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, first of all, what are you trying to tap into here? Some of us are already sort of doing this, but maybe don't even know it. Megan, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So we have a couple of different projects that we're working on as a part of this Global Health Institute project, essentially looking for novel sources of information for discovering wildlife health events in the news, as well as from citizen scientists, and looking through passive observations that are shared with us through Twitter.
And then, Chris, how do you mine this? What kind of things are you watching for on Twitter?
That actually is a better question for Megan.
Oh, I'm sorry,
she's
Megan.
Been working closer with the folks.
Sure. So working with some computer scientists faculty on the UW campus here at UW-Madison, Jerry Zhu and his graduate student, Jun Ming, we've been looking at training his machine learning system, which essentially takes keywords and looks for observations of wildlife health reports from the general public. And we're looking for firsthand reports. So I saw a dead bird or I saw a dead squirrel, things like that. And so in using this machine learning system, we're essentially trying to train it using natural language processing techniques and other techniques to better identify these observations.
So I see a dead crow in my backyard. I type a note, and then this project, ideally, you know, I put it on Twitter or something, and then this project scouts it out and adds it to the data, the roster.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So with the different information channels, that's exactly what we're looking to do, is to glean this very basic epidemiological information from the wildlife health event, you know, where it was located, what kind of species were affiliated there, and some other basic information. And then we can turn those information, that basic kind of passive observation, into a standardized point of data. And that can help to build up what everyone is looking for in kind of the epidemiological health area of baseline understanding. You know, how common are these events? Is this something significant? And so it's in the power of uniting these different sources of novel information that will help to complement the traditional sources that you see coming out of state agencies, federal agencies, and so on.
So do we have a shortfall in the data we have now?
Yes. We are hoping to fill that gap of information with these novel sources, mm-hmm. looking at the news, filtering Twitter, and also significantly getting contributions from citizen scientists. One single report from a person is highly valuable, especially when it contributes to the larger group of observations.
So right now, the people who are tracking this stuff maybe know what's going on state lands, or the stuff the DNR wardens are seeing, but that sounds like a huge gap then to be filled in.
Right, totally. So that's essentially what we're doing, is reaching out to the general public to make them aware of the significance that these individual contributions can make to that baseline understanding, as well as to help identify perhaps something new emerging. So like an example, in the last year or so, there have been some salmonella outbreaks that had to do with birds at bird feeders and perhaps not being as clean as they should be. And so the DNR received a lot of these reports about kind of seeing birds at the bird feeders that had some interesting characteristics, and were able to respond with those citizen observations to say, hey, you know, pull your bird feeders, either keep them down or, you know, wash them with bleach. So it helps with some response strategies as well.
So right now, it sounds like the first step is just taking advantage of what people are already doing. Are you also going to be trying to get more people to go to Twitter, go to Facebook, and make these kind of reports?
Yeah, exactly. We've been doing a number of outreach efforts over the past year, and we're trying to reach both the general public to make them aware of these tools, and that these professionals out there are interested in seeing those observations. And we're also doing outreach to people who might consume that data, who might want to take advantage of the alerts and the email alerts and the RSS alerts that come out of this system, essentially to keep them up to date and provide a possibility for collaboration and communication to respond to these events.
Well, a lot of people care about wildlife, would be interested in helping just for that reason. Is there something more in it for us, though, if we know more about the diseases affecting the non-human animals in our state?
Absolutely. Wildlife health can tell us or be an indication of zoonotic diseases that we as humans need to be concerned about, and also foreign animal diseases that our domestic animals could be a problem for.
So here's what's in it for us. If we tweet sick animals, seeing sick animals, dead animals around, we might help track down a disease that might someday jump to us.
Correct.
Am I hearing that right?
Correct.
Now, let's talk about the concept of citizen science more generally. It's a word, it's a phrase that I've heard floating around a lot. Is there a value to, you know, the non-trained lay people like, you know, me getting involved and helping out with science?
Certainly. I mean, there, if you think about it on the landscape, you know, how many in this particular area, how many wildlife biologists are employed and looking for these observations? And like you said, that they may be biased towards monitoring state or federal lands. And so we've got a large gap in private land ownership and reports that we could take advantage of the general public from. But it's also, you know, I think it's transforming and kind of burgeoning right now, this field of citizen science, because of this access to technology, smartphones, and all these applications that enable people to, you know, easily contribute what they see. And there is some value, you know, that a lot of citizens find from contributing to this data set, especially if they're, you know, shown how this information can be used to supplement this traditional information.
A lot of times when I've heard in the news about citizen science, it's usually in the astronomy field. You know, somebody makes a discovery of a comet, an asteroid, a star, a galaxy, something like that. And I think it's just because there's so much universe out there, all the astronomers can't be watching it all at one time. Are you going for a similar thing with our Wisconsin wildlife?
Absolutely. We are trying to use the power of observations through citizens to expand the capacity to find these events and make a record of them.
Is there any kind of training we could use? I mean, I'm not going out there with a thermometer and sticking it in, you know, a deer's mouth to assess its well-being, right?
No, we do not encourage people to interact with wildlife, whether it's healthy or sick. Mm-hmm. But the basic observations of if you see an animal that appears to be sick, that you can make an observation of the date when it happened, the location, the species, just very basic information can be extremely helpful.
Let's talk about how it works on a practical level. I see that sick animal or the animal acting strangely. I get note the time and place. Do I just tweet it to my buddies, or are there ways that it can be drawn to your attention so that the smart computer doesn't have to dig quite so hard?
Yeah, currently with the one of our projects, the Wildlife Health Event Reporter, anyone, members of the general public or professionals, can sign up for a free account. And then essentially start to make a report, just like Chris said, you know, essentially looking for the date, location, and some basic details. And if there are photos that can go along with it, that might also help a lot, especially on the other end when we invite scientists and researchers to look at this information. Having that additional observation information, such as pictures of the area where the event took place or pictures of the animals themselves, would be very helpful.
Now, who on the other end, we've kind of talked on what we, the citizen scientists, would be doing. You get that data, you surf Twitter, you take these accounts and collect that info. Who then gets to look at it and try to make sense of, uh-oh, we've got a crow disease outbreak in Sector 7?
So oftentimes a lot of these reports really aren't about disease. It's just an observation itself. But those can be very helpful. You know, Chris said on earlier, at the individual level together, they can start to show a picture of where you might raise red flags and see concern. You know, this is still a very experimental tool, but we do have people who monitor and sign up for alerts that come out of the Wildlife Health Event Reporter project. Essentially, anyone can sign up to receive email alerts or RSS feed alerts, which are essentially data. And so that XML RSS feed alert can be linked into outside systems too. So we're not necessarily asking people to, change what they're doing, but provide this additional channel of information.
Did you invent this from whole cloth, or is this something that's working elsewhere and people here in Wisconsin got excited and said, hey, that's an idea we should borrow or steal?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the citizen science kind of application itself is, like you said, it's kind of burgeoning, and a lot of people are starting, scientists are starting to engage the public with their research in order to kind of establish a broader net of observations. In the wildlife health realm, there are a few other applications going on the internet. There are some people who are interested in roadkill observations to help transform kind of transportation planning, or even to monitor habitats that are sensitive, where you might have salamanders doing over road crossings and things like that. But anyway, yeah, it's a pretty broadly used kind of technique to gather additional information.
If we're just about out of time, but I want to know if someone's hearing this and says, I can do that. I can help out. What's their next step? How do they get in touch, or where do they go to find out how to contribute information?
Sure. They can Google Google the Wildlife Health Event Reporter Project, or WHER, WHER, and sign up for an account or some of the alerts that are available there. They can get in touch with us with the School of Veterinary Medicine, Megan Hines and Chris Marsh.
All right. Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Chris, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Megan Hines and Chris Marsh. They are both with the Wildlife Data Integration Network.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about historical and present-day examples of leaders that we can all learn from.
We'll also talk about the history of Latinos in the United States.
And we'll have some advice for the elderly about how to prevent falls, which can have damaging and sometimes disastrous health repercussions for people.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, the air is crisp, the leaves are starting to turn colors, and there's no better time to curl up with a new book. Fall's prime publishing season for books, and many Wisconsin authors have got new books out. Commentator Rod Clark has some thoughts on being a writer from Wisconsin in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
Does being a Wisconsin author mean we have to write about red barns, spotted cows, and sharp cheddar cheese? The late Wisconsin poet John Tushin summed up the dilemma in a poem from the 60s. Wisconsin girl, I love your golden fertilized hair and your red corncob nose, but must you carry that milk pail with you everywhere you go? Last year, an editor from a big publishing house, upon hearing that I was from Wisconsin, told me they were not into regional writers at that time. The implication was that a Wisconsin writer was probably limited to subjects that had no appeal to a national audience, and that pretending we could write well about subjects beyond our borders might be a little presumptuous. From his point of view, Wisconsin writers were limited to rustication or to imitation. This curious prejudice is not just something that comes from outside the state. It comes from us, too. The harsh life of the early Wisconsin frontier instilled in Wisconsinites the notion that art and civilization were things that had to come from distant and sophisticated places like New York, Paris, or San Francisco, and that somehow our reality limited the kinds of art that could be created here. In the last century, ripples from the Wisconsin idea and the spirit of progressivism began to alter the idea that real art couldn't come from here. But I believe that the concept did not truly begin to loosen its evil grip until the late 60s. Then, when we sat down in the heart of America's dairyland to write a poem or make a painting or create some music, we didn't wait around to find out how it should be done. Instead, we filled the blanks with what we drew from our own flesh and bones and the land under our feet. From the physical and spiritual territory that has been called the Third Coast or the Middle Coast, a land whose limbs were wrapped in water west of Michigan, south of Superior, east of the Mississippi. And I guess we are a little insular. Like Paul Bunyan's Round River, a ring of water flowing into itself. Yet in that very insularity lies a kind of creative independence from national opinion, a cheeky assumption that we can write whatever we please, and that what we write here can be as good as anything written anywhere else.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. You can find out more information at wisconsinlife.org.
You'll be able to see some authors from the Badger State at this year's Wisconsin Book Festival.
And here to let us know what to expect is Connor Moran, Wisconsin Book Festival Director. Connor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about some of the highlights. I mean, I know they're all highlights to
they
you.
Are.
It's hard to pick, but you know, just give us some of the stuff that we really want to make sure to catch.
Well, some of the things I'm very excited about, the festival itself takes place from October 17th through the 20th. And really, I should say the thing I'm most excited about is being able to showcase the new Central Library here in Madison.
Yes, I was there this weekend.
Yeah, it just opened up on Saturday, and everyone should come, if not to see the great authors, to see the library in full effect. But we're going to get started with the festival a little bit early on October 4th with Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He's the initial sponsor of the DREAM Act, and he's written a book called Still Dreaming about growing up poor in the barrio and getting all the way to Capitol Hill. That event will be Friday, October 4th at Monona Terrace. I really think that's going to be a special night. Also very excited about having Stephen Jimenez at the Central Library on Saturday, October 19th. His book about the Matthew Shepard murder and events surrounding it really sheds new light on something that we all kind of think we understand or have a good grip on. I think that'll be a very important and moving evening. And then closing the festival, well, that'll be nice for me because I'll be done with 50 events over 4 days. but we'll have Alan Salkin for his book From Scratch, which is a really dishy, gossipy tell-all of the Food Network.
So, are we going to get Paula Deen gossip?
Probably. I imagine there will be some Q&A about Paula Deen.
So I'm curious, you know, you mentioned the new Central Library. Are there new venues that you're working with this year?
So one of the things that we've really tried to do, in addition to taking over the festival after 11 great years with the Wisconsin Humanities Council, we have tried to, in addition to having a philosophical home at the library, have a geographical home in and around the library. So we've reduced the number of venues to 8 this year, and all of them are walkable from the Central Library. So we really encourage people to come down, park your car once, come to something, go get lunch, walk next door to the Overture Center, see something else, come back to Central Library. So there's a very nice kind of neighborhood of venues, and we're really able to give you that festival atmosphere that a lot of Madison's other great festivals have.
Well, I noticed on the docket something I'm excited about. There's going to be a graphic novel panel as well.
Yeah, that'll be really a wonderful way to showcase some wonderful local talent and Linda Berry, and also some talent from Chicago with Chris Ware and Ivan Brunetti. In addition to that graphic novels panel, there will be an illustrator conversation with those three and local illustrator Brian Moro Cribbs earlier in the day. So some great art events at this year's festival.
So now, if someone isn't familiar with book festivals per se, it might seem like a funny thing to have a festival around because books are so solitary. You read to yourself or to your children. Mm-hmm. But you know, what can people expect at a book festival?
Well, I think that while you're totally right about the act of reading, one of the things that I like most about reading is then sharing and talking about books with other people. And so one thing that'll be great about having so many events, 30 of the 50 events this year will occur at Central Library, is you'll have people who are able to talk about not only enjoying that book, but what did I see? What did I miss? What am I excited about seeing later? Let's walk across the street to this Wisconsin Historical Museum and see something there. And really being able to kind of connect with other people who are passionate about the things you're passionate about, I think is one of the reasons to have the festival, and also for people to learn what they should read over the winter.
There we go. The long reading season is about upon us. Well, what about Wisconsin authors? We just heard that Wisconsin Life piece featuring a Wisconsin author. Who are some other Wisconsin authors that will be here at the book festival?
We have quite a few. Some really great events with local Madison author Dale Kushner for her debut novel, The Conditions of Love, and Susanna Daniel for her novel, Sea Creatures. We also have Dean Jensen, who is from Milwaukee, and he's written a book called Queen of the Air about a circus performer who actually lived in Baraboo and was one of the most famous women in the world at the turn of the last century.
At the Circus Museum area there?
Yeah, I think she lived up in Baraboo before then going on tour. And I think that'll be, her name is Lietzel, and people know her apparently. But that'll be a really interesting event. We'll also have some great events with Jody LePage, who wrote a book called Sister, which is an oral history of a woman's struggle to prove that her brother's murder was actually a murder by the Milwaukee police. That's a really affecting and moving story. And many, many other local authors.
And anything for aspiring writers?
Well, we have workshop that is actually being put on by Linda Berry and novelist Dan Sean. That'll be Sunday morning at the festival. Registration is required for that, but it basically is for anyone from all walks of writership. So it doesn't matter if you write all the time or you've never written and you just want to kind of learn how. That workshop will be great. And then in addition to the events at the 4-day celebration in October, the Wisconsin Book Festival in becoming part of Madison Public Library is going to incorporate, and we have been throughout the year, Wisconsin Book Festival events. So we're looking at some self-publishing workshops coming up in 2014, in addition to other events that will kind of keep that festival atmosphere going at the public library throughout the year.
Now, you said the festival starts October 17th.
Starts October 17th at 11:30 in the morning with Emily Oster for her book, Expecting Better. Yeah.
And who we have had on the show.
Oh, so she's great.
If listeners want to hear her, see her live and in person, you can catch her at the Wisconsin Book Festival. And I hope, Connor, that you are sleeping a lot. because I've heard that this is a marathon for directors of the book festival.
I have some days off coming on October 21st and 22nd.
And spend them all sleeping is my advice to you.
Probably
you'll be busy. Well, it sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
We've been talking to Connor Moran, director of the Wisconsin Book Festival, and the festival runs, as we just heard, from October 17th to the 20th.
Coming up next, we'll talk about how scarcity shapes our lives, our society, and our culture. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, this is Banned Books Week. We'll hear from the American Library Association about what books get banned or challenged and why.
First, if you ever feel pressed for time or short on cash, you're familiar with the concept of scarcity. But our next guest says there's a lot you may not know about how running short on time or money can affect the way we think and make decisions.
Eldar Shafir joins us now. He's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Eldar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we usually think of being short on time and short on money as very different things, but your book starts with a realization about the similarities between being crunched for time, crunched for money. How are they similar?
Well, if you think about it, even intuitively and certainly in the research we've done, it turns out that when you feel a lack of time or money, you spend a lot of time focusing on it. You spend a lot of time juggling the thing you don't have enough of. And as it turns out, when you spend a lot of bandwidth, a lot of attention to that topic, you have less mind left for other things in your life.
It makes sense that we juggle the thing we're worried about, but our brains, for some reason, it sounds like, take it to an extreme. Why do we have that hyper-tunnel-style focus on that?
Well, it sort of comes almost automatically. You know, what's interesting if you look at behavioral work is that, you know, we don't have full control about how our brains process information. You know, we walk around like the proud owners of this machine and we think we know what it's doing and that we can control it. But the fact is, you know, we don't really understand or control it any better than we do our liver. And so our brain basically focuses on this thing that's disturbing us, focuses on the thing we're feeling threatened by or preoccupied with. Often, what we call in the book tunneling, often leads us to focus on it excessively and sort of lose sight of the periphery.
So what is going on with our decision-making when we are in this time crunch or when we're realizing that we're short for cash or whatever other resource we're short on?
Well, we focus on it. We do the best we can. As it turns out, if we look, for example, at poverty and those who are experiencing money scarcity, they do very well managing the moment-to-moment exigencies, emergencies that come up, but they pay a price of neglecting things in the periphery. You know, there's a fire, there's a bucket of water next to you. You don't spend too much time inquiring how much that bucket of water is going to cost. You pour it on the fire. You take a payday loan, which ends up being at massively high interest. Right now, it solves the problem fairly well. And then it turns out a week or two from now, you owe more money than you can afford and you enter a poverty trap of a sort.
So these short-term decisions we make under the stress of that scarcity may not be in our long-term best interest. Is that a pretty common theme that you found studying scarcity?
Indeed, it is. It's often the case, you know, you focus and you neglect the consequences that emerge later and the peripheral decisions that to some extent you've neglected. Often the very act of focusing basically diminishes the quality of your decision because the brain is so preoccupied with it. So, for example, another form of scarcity we discuss is loneliness, you know, the scarcity of social connections. Interestingly, it turns out that some people who experience extreme loneliness, who are concerned with, you know, making connections and friends, when they're not thinking about it, our research shows are socially very appropriate, adequate, just as good as anybody else. But once loneliness impinges on their thinking, once they're focusing on loneliness, they do less well. So interestingly, when they meet somebody and the issue of social connections emerges as very topical in their heads and occupies their attention, at that very moment when they meet somebody, they function less well. Too much of their attention is devoted to the topic. They stop responding well. They don't engage well. They don't tell jokes at the right moment, and they end up being less adequate than they would have been otherwise, which further hurts their ability to socialize well.
So their focus on loneliness makes them ultimately more lonely because of that chain of decisions.
Indeed. It just takes mental bandwidth and leaves less for functioning well at that moment.
Well, it sounds like there's a core scarcity here, and it's that mental bandwidth you're talking about. Is our brain capacity that finite that if we focus on one important thing, we really lose that much of everything else?
Exactly. In other words, you know, we have, you know, the brain has different compartments. There is a long-term memory, the things that, you know, birthday dates that you know, phone numbers you know, that's, you know, massive capacity. But working memory, the part that you juggle in real time, the things you attend to, that's very limited, much more than we appreciate. So if you've seen recent work, for example, on the use of cell phones and cars, you know, it turns out that we think we can have no problem dividing our attention, multitasking, and basically it turns out that multitasking is just another word for not paying attention. And that, you know, using a cell phone in the car is basically equivalent in terms of your reaction times and your ability to attend. It's roughly equivalent to being legally drunk. And so, you know, our capacity is, in fact, very limited. Cognitive psychologists for, you know, 3 decades now have done very simple manipulations where I give you either a 7-digit number to keep in your head to remember or a 2-digit number. And when you keep a 7-digit number in your head, try not to forget it, you do less well elsewhere. You're even more likely to eat a brownie as opposed to a piece of fruit when you walk down a room because you're less attending to what it is you should or shouldn't eat, and you just perform less well elsewhere.
I hate to use computer metaphors for the brain, but it seems like it's apt here. My computer can hold lots of data that I'm not accessing right now, but if I start running too many applications, too many programs, it starts to slow down.
You sound like you read a chapter of our book.
I read a little more than that, I'll be honest.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the metaphors we use, exactly. Or, you know, think of an air traffic controller. You're keeping many planes in the air, and all of a sudden one of them has got major trouble, and you focus on that heavily, which is not a bad thing to do. In fact, it's the right thing to do to some extent. But then you neglect other planes in the air, and that could lead to great difficulties.
You mentioned that brownie a minute ago, which reminded me of another of the things that's a scarcity, that's a finite quantity, self-control. You write about that a little bit. And that's not something I usually tend to think of as a resource, like I might think of money or I might think of time. How is self-control a scarce object?
Well, the way it relates to scarcity, again, has to do with the attention you're able to pay. So imagine that, you know, I'm trying to cut down on my consumption of bread. You know, I'd rather not eat bread. And we go to a restaurant for lunch, you and I, and we have a very intense and interesting conversation. And somebody leaves bread on the table, and I eat it. I eat it not because I looked at the bread and said, I don't want to eat it, but I can't resist. I eat it because I didn't even notice it. Now, I look like somebody who failed to exercise self-control because I'm not intending to be a bread eater. But in fact, to a large extent, I failed to resist not because of weakness of will, but because of lack of attention. And so a lot of cases that look like weakness of will basically have to do with people's behavior that comes sort of from acting automatically without enough cognitive control to impose on where it is that you pay your attention and how you choose.
And then if my life's going swimmingly and my attention isn't occupied, my bandwidth isn't getting eaten up, I might have more to devote for self-control and no brownie for me. But I think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of stress eating. Is that the explanation?
You know, there's other things going on, of course, but that's a massive contributor, basically. You know, the other thing is, you know, all of us have a lot of concerns, a lot of preoccupations, but what's interesting is in many cases, like you and I have many major concerns in our lives, but most of them can wait. So, you know, when we're having a half-hour conversation on the phone or on the radio, we decide to leave our preoccupations for later this afternoon. But when something's impinging on your attention heavily, like, you know, the preoccupation of how to pay rent at the end of this month or not having any friends or things of that sort, sometimes it's hard to control, so that they impinge on your performance even in moments when you'd rather focus on something else. So that's the kind of things that we come up, you know, in the studies we conduct, where we simply show that the poor perform less well even when they try to take tests that we give them.
And if the money is looking better for that poor person and they've got their rent in hand, they might perform better on the same test?
That's the kind of studies we do. So, you know, we go to the mall, we get people to participate in the study, we give them classic cognitive tests that gauge your ability to control your attention, your cognitive control, as well as fluid intelligence. It's a major component of IQ. And we give them these tests, and in the background, we present them with a financial scenario, a hypothetical financial scenario, so your car breaks down. And that scenario comes in 2 versions. Some of them get a manageable version, where the car is going to cost $150 to fix, which we know most of them can do. And the other comes at $1,500 to fix, which we know that for many people in the mall presents a serious challenge. And we get household income, so we know, we divide them by splitting them in half into rich and poor. And if you look at what they do, the rich people in the mall, when they perform these tests with a background of either the easy-to-fix car or the more challenging car, they do equally well on these tests. It doesn't really matter. The poor people in the mall, and by that I mean they're not, you know, objectively poor, they're just lower income, when they are concerned with fixing the cheaper car, they do exactly as well as the rich. They perform equally well on IQ and cognitive control tests. But when they're preoccupied with a more difficult car to manage, with a more expensive car, they now perform significantly less well. Their cognitive control is lower, self-control, managing resources is lower, and their IQ is something like the equivalent of 13 IQ points lower when they're preoccupied by a more expensive car.
Is it the same for someone who has money and is okay on money but is intentionally being frugal and weighing each financial decision? Is that the same as somebody who doesn't have enough money and is weighing each of those decisions?
That's a beautiful question. You know, there's probably going to be individual differences. In most cases, frugality is a discretionary thing. You know, you choose to be frugal, and in moments when things interfere or impose themselves on you, you have the option to be less frugal for a day or two. You know, when we diet, there's a lot of data on how diet imposes a major cognitive load on us. You know, it takes a lot of our attention. And if you have a very important exam to prepare or things to do, you just stop dieting for 2 or 3 days and go back to it. Of course, what happens with genuine poverty as opposed to frugality is that, you know, you don't have that option to say, no, this week I won't be poor, I'll go back to it next week. And so in that sense, it imposes itself on a very different level that's not discretionary and, you know, it's quite stressful.
What I want to start talking about what we can learn from this. What can we say change in an anti-poverty program that might recognize some of the things you're talking about?
Right. So, first of all, a footnote that's good to keep in mind. You know, when you think about the studies we did in the mall, as well as Indian farmers and many others, you know, these are not people in abject poverty. So when we look at the people we encounter in the mall who would divide into rich and poor, these are people who are not poor, they're just budget constrained. They're people who, once you present these issues, impose on their minds because they're budgeting carefully and not easily managing to finish the month. So this is, you know, 100 million Americans, maybe 150 million Americans and growing. So this is a major segment of the population. Now, what to do? You know, the general lesson from this is that we have to be much more preoccupied by bandwidth. We have to be preoccupied by the imposition that we put on people's attention and the demands we put on their cognitive capacity when we run programs and do things of that sort. When you give people automatic deposits, automatic payments, when you schedule their income at regular dates as opposed to unpredictable dates, when their working hours are predictable from day to day and from week to week, so as opposed to, you know, the discovering the day before what hours I work tomorrow and have to worry about arranging childcare, anything you do to facilitate bandwidth, notice what happens. It facilitates bandwidth all throughout their lives. You know, it's the same limited bandwidth that we have in this machinery behind the eyes and between the ears that serves us for everything we do. It's a bandwidth we use to remember to take our medications on time, to exercise restraint and control with our children, to do our budgeting. It's all the same bandwidth. So once you liberate some bandwidth for me, once you make my parts of my everyday life more manageable, less threatening, you have now allowed me to be a better parent, to take my medication on time more often.
We're talking to Eldar Shafir about his new book, Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, and we'll pick up what we can do with this information after the news.
And we want to hear from you. Was it hard for you to get out of the mindset of scarcity, be it for money or time or self-control? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time.